Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and we're back into covering the Constitution. Want to focus on that. I know that there's... I'm going to just say there's going to be a lot of urgency as we get closer to the election, as we start, you know, recognizing how much closer we are to losing everything, because it just seems like more and more people are starting to wake up and realize this. And that, welcome to the club. Welcome to being awake. Anyway, welcome back, Tammy, and appreciate
Thank
your
you.
Appreciate your joining us. We just kind of covered the Article 5 process, right? We covered the two types of processes. There's the legislature, and then there's the state process. And both ways have a process that requires ratification, and there are two processes of that. It is either done by the state legislature or by convention. So then we covered that there were two kinds of amendments that could not be passed. In other words, you couldn't use an amendment to basically change two things within the Constitution. And I'll help with one of them. One of them was to end the slave trade so that the states would no longer be able to have control over the importation of people. That we would go strictly to a single person-by-person immigration process. So, what was that other amendment that could not be passed? Do you know?
I don't recall.
Okay, so it's that part in purple with yellow text that no state can lose or be deprived of its equal suffrage without its consent. And that's not the language. It says that without its consent, that without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage. I think I'm missing a state there. I think that that actually should have a state, right? So go
that
ahead.
No state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate.
Yeah, so mine was compressed that no state was off the page, so... I see what I did. I made the thing too small for me. All right, there we go. So, okay, so does that make sense? So, in other words, yeah. The 17th Amendment may have changed the process of how we select senators, but the senators, because the 17th Amendment does not cover the suffrage, the responsibility of what the senators are supposed to do. It only changed how they were selected, how they were appointed. They still have the responsibility of providing suffrage for the state legislature. Because it's clear right there that the 17th Amendment did not get that, nor could an amendment, in other words, nor could three-fourths of the states take away a single state's suffrage. So in other words, if you actually had an amendment where the Senate would no longer, you know, provide suffrage for the state legislature, it would require 100% of the states for it to be applied to all of the states.
Right.
Okay. All right. So anyway, I've sometimes it's important to drag a dead horse through the mud twice. So I just wanted to make sure that people understand that the 17th Amendment and the way things are going by the representation, by the Senate no longer offering suffrage for the state legislature, that the way they're executing, the way the Senate is behaving, they're directly violating Article 5 of the Constitution. Now we're going to dive into Article 6. Article 6 deals with debts and those types of things, and it also creates or provides the Supremacy Clause, and it will also provide the requirements for the oath or affirmation. So go ahead and let's start with the unhighlighted part, because this is kind of just an initial statement that has kind of become or I should say rendered insignificant. Go ahead.
All debts contracted and engagements entered into before the adoption of this Constitution shall be as valid against the United States under this Constitution as under the Confederation.
Okay, so these are the engagements that, and I talked about this just on Friday last week, that these engagements deal with those obligations, those treaties, debts, and or what have you, that the Articles of Confederation, or should say Continental Congress, had made with other nations and those engagements with other nations. This has nothing to do with any of the domestic matters between Continental Congress and this new Congress. So they just wanted to make sure that there wasn't a, I'll just say this panic in France and all these other nations go, hey, they owe us a lot of money. They just changed their government out on us. They wanted to make sure that they had full assurance that they were going to abide by whatever agreements were created already. So the next part is where we talk about the Supremacy Clause. So go ahead.
This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land.
Okay, so we can stop there.
Okay.
Because there are two major things that jump out that we put in yellow. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, this is the kicker part, it's all in yellow now, which shall be made in pursuance thereof. So in other words, the laws that they're going to make must be made in pursuant to the Constitution. So in other words, only the laws that are in pursuant to the Constitution shall be the supreme law, because at the very end you said shall be the supreme law of the land. So remember, they have this ability up in Article 1, Section 8, that Congress can create laws that are respecting the territories and or the seat of government, Washington, D.C. So that doesn't mean that every law that Congress makes is constitutional. And right. Interestingly enough, Congress lots of times doesn't basically indicate. I mean, you know, they never say that this law is only for the states. They just create laws and they usually send them to where they've been intended. But over the past two centuries, Congress has gotten to the point where it creates a law and they believe it's just applicable to everybody. All the states, as well as the District of Columbia, and as well as the territories. So if those laws are not in pursuance to, if they're not based upon the enumerated objects in the Constitution, then they're not applicable. But the only way to actually clarify, or actually when they create those laws, to have them undone, now the Supreme Court can basically say, hey, you made a mistake, that law is not applicable. But when the Supreme Court doesn't do that, because the Supreme Court is passive, let me make this really clear. The Supreme Court doesn't have the ability to sit and, you know, run over to Congress and say, hey, stop, you can't do that. They have to wait for somebody to bring up a suit, and it takes a long time to go down that path. So this is one of the reasons why during the ratification debates and even in the Federalist Papers, there was these constant, you know, articulations or these responses that said that the states needed to create the barriers. The states needed to create a process of engaging the federal government to say, hold on here, you can't do this. So as we kind of look at this, you know, the Supremacy Clause, when they create this law, and back in those days, it took time for these things to actually get to us. Today, how long does it take for information to get to us? No time at all. And as a matter of fact, they can get a copy, a draft. Hey, we're looking at creating this bill. they have the ability to send a draft to the state legislatures, to all of the states, to all the people. They can just post it and say, hey, we just posted something that you may want to see, and everybody can go look at it. They didn't have this level of transparency or the opportunity to be this transparent. And so there's no doubt in my mind that the framers, because they didn't see this, they didn't include that down the road, you know, as mechanisms, communications, and those types of things improve, that the interoperability between the federal government and the states shall keep pace with, you know, those improvements in technology to ensure that by the time, you know, we can actually have almost real-time acquiescence, the states should actually be able to start participating more in telling the federal government, hold on here, and engaging them where they don't be. But over this time, over this century plus, the federal government assumed the authority of being the master. Well, they're only the master over these things delegated. All things not delegated are reserved to the states. That's why the 10th Amendment exists. So anyway, I got to emphasize this, that they're only, the only laws that are applicable to the states are those that are derived from the objects within the Constitution. They can't be implied. They have to derive from the objects. And what that means is if it regarding a uniform act of naturalization and or bankruptcies, then they can create a law regarding the naturalization process to become a citizen. And they already defined those things. So once they create these definitions that this is what we're doing and this is why we're doing it and this is how it's going to be done, then the only thing they change is how it's going to be done. The why and the what stays the same. So they can't just start making it up and redefining things to say, you know, we consider all foreigners of the world to be citizens of the United States and citizens of the United States to be foreigners. They can't do that, even though it seems like that's what the court and that's the direction they're trying to take us. But anyway, go ahead.
So if you started to say, you said the only way to have the laws undone.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. The only way to have the law, the only way to have the laws undone is for the parties to step up and challenge the federal government, say, where do you have the authority to do this? In other words, the states need to initiate republic review. And technically, this is not some, you know, formal process that you have to put on certain robes and, you know, have to don certain gear or anything like that. All you need to do is have the states basically stand up, unite. We only need 50% plus. In other words, we only need a majority of the states to actually stand up and say, and a majority of the states that control Congress. So that may be 27, 29 states, somewhere in there. But we only need those states to actually step up. Once you have a majority, you now have control over Congress, which means you have a control over the federal government. Because Congress is, in essence, the federal government. The president is only the executive of faithfully executing the laws and having veto power and treaty power and those things. But technically, you know, we don't seize control of the president because the president isn't the sovereign. Sovereigns are those who create laws, change laws, and get rid of laws. The courts do not have the power or authority to do that. They can basically rule regarding the law and facts. So they can't create law, they can't change law, they can't get rid of law. They can basically tell the legislature, or I should say Congress, to say, you know what, this law is wrong, it's unjust. They don't have the authority to actually strike it. Only the states have the authority to step in on things that are not delegated. In other words, if the federal government started creating laws regarding the environment, which is clearly not delegated, the states are obligated to stand up and say, hold on, you don't have that authority. So just cool your jets, get rid of that stuff. And if you want to be able to create environmental laws, then let's see an amendment to the Constitution first so that we can delegate the power that we want you to have regarding that. And folks, my recommendation has always been never give the federal government controls over domestic matters. It was not designed to do that. It was designed to fight our wars and to protect our sovereignty. Let's keep it focused on those things and allow the states to do what they need to do to bolster our productivity, our tranquility internally. I mean, I think we can be adults enough to get along and work together on solving our problems and creating our own strategies instead of allowing the federal government to tell us what our energy strategy should be. They don't have the authority to do that. So now, thank you for pointing that out. Now I've answered that question. That's how we do it. We actually have to take interposition. We have to act and assert our authority as the states, as the parties to the compact. And as a matter of fact, as soon as we get done with this, Tammy, you and I are going to go back into the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. We'll probably cover them again, and then we'll kind of go through these things so that we can talk about how simple this process is. Back in Madison and Jefferson's day, it was a little cumbersome because they didn't have direct lines of communications like we do today. There's no reason why we would have to wait a month or two to actually start, you know, getting feedback. We could clearly be able to refute, shut down these nonsense arguments and start working together to actually seize control of the federal government in ways of operating that they have no authority to do. So the next part of this is, and all treaties, right? You said that, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States. That's the next big part we got to talk about. So what that means is that if they're going to create a treaty, the only treaties that they can create are those things that they have the authority. That's why under the authority of the United States is added. They can't just go create a treaty to undermine the whole concept of this Constitution and the concept of what the government's supposed to do. It's supposed to guard our sovereignty. So if they created a treaty with some club, this international club that's going to govern all states, and they say, you know, we want to become a part of that. The only way they can actually create a treaty with the United Nations and make us a part of and subject to, we would have to amend the Constitution to say, you have the authority to adjoin to foreign polities and, you know, and surrender our sovereignty to those polities. That we haven't read that in the Constitution, have we? We haven't read anywhere where we've given them or delegated them the authority to subjugate us to foreign nations, have we?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely not.
Right. So if they don't have the authority, that's what it says right there. It says, this Constitution and all laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. So in other words, if they don't have the authority, if we never gave them that authority in the Constitution, they can't do it.
But the UN and the WHO... I mean, all kinds of treaties.
All sorts of foreign treaties, correct. And as a matter of fact, you know, it's worth actually doing this because this was really clarified by Mr. George Nicholas. He said, this is in the Virginia ratification debates. I'll reread it now. This is what he said regarding treaties. He said, have we not seen in America that treaties were violated, though they are in all countries considered as the supreme law of the land? Was it not therefore necessary to declare in explicit terms that they should be so here? How then is this Constitution on any different footing from the government of Britain? The worthy member, somebody was basically arguing that they could use the treaties to surrender us and to actually take us over. And he says, the worthy member says that they can make a treaty relinquishing our rights and inflicting punishments, because all treaties are declared paramount to the constitutions and laws of the states. An attentive consideration of this will show that the committee, will show the committee that they can do no such thing. The provision of the sixth article, which is what we just read, is that this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, which are made under the authority, or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. They can by this make no treaty which shall be repugnant to the spirit of the Constitution or inconsistent with the delegated powers. The treaties they make must be under the authority to be within their province. It is sufficiently secured because it can only, because it only declares that in pursuance to of the powers given, in pursuance of the powers given, they shall be the supreme law of the land, notwithstanding anything in the Constitution or laws of particular states. So in other words, if it's not enumerated, if it's not delegated to them, they can't create a treaty over that matter.
Yeah.
And they've been making up treaties on the environment, on refugee settlements, and all of it, and health. They have no authority to do any of it.
Yeah.
So, because I say this, and because, you know, this is really, this is so clear, who do you think is public enemy number one? Now, most people would say I am, but sadly, our government has become public enemy number one because they're doing all sorts of things to us that they have no authority to do.
Yeah.
When we stand up and we start saying, hey, where is your authority to do that? Because truly the enemy is the person that is violating the law. Those who are actually doing things that are wrong. So, I mean, in the old days when they identified, you know, public enemy number one was Bonnie and Clyde or, you know, whatever, these bad criminals. But the people that are the criminals, unfortunately, has become our government because we're not holding them accountable. So when we dive into the last part of this, let's go ahead and do that. Go ahead and read the last part all over again so we can dive into that too.
Okay, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby anything... Well, hold on. Shall be bound thereby anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding.
So in other words, they are bound by the Constitution of these laws. Not, and so no other thing can they allow themselves to view and make decisions and rule, you know, providing the ruling on the disposition of a case, whether it be an original case or an appeal case. The point is that they can't use, like when Ruth Bader Ginsburg actually used international law in one of her rulings and opinions, she violated the Constitution because the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. And no other thing can be used other than the law and facts. So to be clear, the Supreme Court is basically constrained by those things arising under this Constitution. Even though their mighty, powerful minds are capable of thinking and resolving every problem in the world, they are to be constrained to these things that are enumerated and all things arising under this Constitution and nothing more. Because abortion does not arise under this Constitution, they have no jurisdiction. Because international law does not arise under this Constitution, they have no jurisdiction. Only disputes with other nations, with other polities, they can step in and then do that. We're going to go into a break, obviously, right here. So, see, I'm getting better, but watch tomorrow, I'll be worse again. But when we come back, we're going to move forward into the oath portion, which is the last part of Article 6. So when we come back, we will actually cover the last remnants of Article 6 and then move into Article 7. So we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so now we're going to go into the oath and affirmation that is required to support this Constitution. Now, let me just lead into this. This oath right here is very specific. This is a standing requirement that before a person can do anything, they must take an oath. So go ahead and let's dive into this.
The senators and representatives before mentioned and the members of the several state legislatures and all executive and judicial offices, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution, but no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States.
Okay, so they're talking about anybody and everybody that's elected, because they're talking about legislators, they're talking about executives and judicial offices, the judiciary, in other words, all judges. So does that mean the other offices like clerks and so forth? Absolutely. Every person that is going to step in, because one of the things that we kind of covered, or we really glossed over it, and I think I just mentioned it in passing, that the very first act Congress actually signed off on, voted and signed off on, was the process of how people were to be sworn in. That's how important this part of the Constitution is. This is what they did first, because they wanted to make sure everything that was being done under the authority and basically valid. Because what happens when people start behaving without being sworn in? Well, that makes it invalid. They don't have the authority. The process of making somebody legitimately giving them the legitimate authority of their office is the swearing in. It's not the election. The election actually basically says, okay, now you are to be seated in that office. You still have to be sworn in before you can perform your functions and your duties, period. So anyway, when we look at the who, then that means everybody. But it says this, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution, not any other Constitution. Do you think it was a happen chance that they actually used the specificity of this? Do you think it's just
not
at all? That's right, because they didn't know, but maybe the divine hand of providence knew that the constitutions would change and they would try to redefine it, that we would probably end up with the annotated constitution or living constitution that the federal government wants to use, because it sure makes their life easier when they can make it up and define things the way they want to. I mean, you're a mother. You've seen kids play. And you've probably seen how kids will start trying to concoct a game of how to play because they don't have, you know, they're too young or what have you to, you know, to play computer games or what have you. So they're just learning to play together and they start making up rules. Well, they can't do that, or at least our government can't do that. They're not children. They can't make it up as they go along. They have to swear to support this Constitution and these laws, not, you know, some other Constitution and make up their own rules as they go along. In other words, this Constitution is fixed. The only time this Constitution can change is when?
When they ratify it.
When it's amended via the full process. In other words, Congress submits it, the states ratify it, and now it is amended because that is the process. It's not an amendment. The Constitution is not changed if the states have not ratified it. Just because the federal government said, well, you know, this is really good for us to do. You know, and here's the problem. When, you know, it's got, have you ever played the game Simon Says?
Oh, yeah.
And there, so there's this really specific rule that Simon has to say it. And so what happens if all of a sudden, because, it, you know, technically, instead of saying Simon says, it's the state says. And the federal government comes along and says, you know, as the states go, hey, can you help us with disasters, with some of these disaster problems? We'd like you to do that. And so the states say that. And the federal government comes back and says, here's money to take care of these problems within these states that have been decimated. Well, actually, they couldn't do that because the states didn't say that. The states required that the Constitution actually has to be amended, even though they didn't say that, because before the federal government can do anything, the states actually have to say you can do that. Just because they said that they would like to have that done doesn't mean it can be done. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a good comparison.
So the federal government, to behave properly, they have to say, oh, they want us to do this, and the process here means that we have to create an amendment so that they can give us this authority to do this. But the states, because the federal government came along and said, you know, because you're not thinking of state says and the rules of state says, like Simon says, then we're just going to give this money over to these people. And see, isn't this great? We did this. And the dumb states that say, oh, well, yeah, they clap their hands, good job. And, you know, all they're doing is hoodwinking bad behavior.
Yeah.
They have the obligation. The states, as when we get back into the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, not ratifications, the resolutions, we're going to prove that the states absolutely have to ensure that every step is being, all T's are crossed and all I's are dotted, so that we can actually make sure that the federal government is behaving the way it's supposed to behave. Anyway, so that really does wrap up the oath. But this last part, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. Why is this? Why is it that they basically made a ban on religious tests?
Well, because that would be against the Constitution.
Okay. Why did they put it in the Constitution?
Because in England, they used it against them.
So actually, the difference was, in England, they actually were a theocracy. They created a state religion. It was the Episcopal Church. Before that, it was the Catholic Church. And so the law was basically dictated and managed by the church. The fundamental law of the land was the Bible. And then they had this general constitution that empowered the king through coronation and so forth, that he could do anything and everything he wanted as long as he didn't violate the Magna Carta or the Bill of Rights. In other words, the Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights were reservations that were placed upon the king, that he could do whatever he wanted as long as he didn't do these things. And see, when they created the Constitution, they said, why should we do that? That is just, that is an accident waiting to happen. Because how can you think about something that's going to be developed down the road in years from now, like technology or something else, to where, you know, they've created something new, and because we didn't list it, then they're going to be able to say, yeah, we're going to do this too. It's easier to say you can only do these things than it is to go ahead and do everything except these things. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, you could basically den or confine the government to the very specific objects that you've allowed them to do, so that if they need to do something more, they got to come back and we'll amend the Constitution and allow them to do a little more. But to let them do everything except for, this is where they kept on making the point that only a fool thinks that you can list and think of everything government can do to hurt you when you give them blank authority. We need to make sure that they only can do these things, then we don't have to worry. Can they take away our religious rights and our prayers and regulate our religion? No, it's not delegated to them. Can they delegate life or abortion and those types? No, they're not to do that. The federal government was defined to do only these very specific things, like mail. Right, the post office and providing a mail service so that we could communicate. That was their job. Now, let me ask you this. Under the guise of the U.S. Postal Service, do you think that government could have assumed email?
Why not?
Why not? And as a matter of fact, they could have actually gone down the path, but because it was a complete transition from one world to another, I honestly think it would have required, because that was physical mail. Electronic mail wasn't stipulated. So, and the movement of data, even though everything that you can put into on paper, into a box or into a parcel envelope or what have you, you can do, you know, electronically, even images. I mean, it's just data. But if it's like liquid or, you know, food or something like that, you can't transmit that. At least we haven't developed that technology like Star Trek, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But eventually we might be able to actually transport anything and everything via, you know, technology. Should the government do that? It's this becomes the question that we have to answer. But at this point in time, they're limited to the physical, you know, shipment of mail and so forth. So when FedEx and the UPS came along to compete with the federal mail system, then we go, okay, so isn't that a good thing? What do you think? It was a good thing for FedEx and UPS to come along and actually, you know, create a competition?
I mean, I've heard you say no. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, so I think that we would have been better served to make the improvements, or to have the Postal Service make the improvements necessary to be able to do what needed to be done to satisfy the needs. The problem is that, you know, when we look at what it takes to mail a letter, why is it that people don't mail a letter with FedEx? Because it costs an arm and a leg to do that.
Yeah.
But you can, you know, they'll be happy to do the express. Well, it forced the federal government and the Postal Service to start doing that. But bottom line, when we got to a point where we wanted the federal government to, or we wanted the movement and shipment of any and all things, it would have been better to basically have the federal government accommodate that properly. And but the problem is, it's just this monstrosity, and they shouldn't have these monstrosities. It shouldn't be that difficult. Government shouldn't be that difficult. Now, having gone into the contracting, I'll give you a good example. when the Navy, I think, required, or some military branch required the ability, I think it was the Air Force, required the ability to use a hammer in space. And they said, this hammer has to be able to be used and functioned in these conditions. So what does that mean? The manufacturer actually had to create those conditions to be able to test, to prove that that hammer could actually function in those conditions. So in other words, the government basically said, you know, we're only going to buy, you know, 100 hammers, but you have to create this test where you can actually make it so that it's, you know, freezing cold, that it's in a vacuum lab, you know, all of these types of conditions that you would experience in space to prove that that hammer would work. So what happens to the cost of that hammer?
It goes up.
It goes up. It goes up dramatically. And so the question is that reasonable? Should the company have done that? Or is that something that maybe the government or the military, Air Force, because don't they have those types of chambers? Couldn't they just use that same chamber that they replicate things, they do their own testing and deployment with, in, you know, gravity-free space and all of that? Why couldn't they, this contractor, use that? The point is that we actually think in silos, and we're not working together to try to actually be more efficient, more efficacious for we the people, and ensuring the government is capable of doing those few things it needs to do and not doing everything else. So when we look at this religious test, back to the religious test, when they said every state in the union wanted to have a religious test, but then we're talking about the federal government. And so Madison basically said, okay, let's create a religious test. Just tell me whose Bible we're going to use. And everybody wanted their Bible to be used. And no Bible, you know, the Puritans, there were very significant differences between these Bibles and the interpretation and the doctrine. Do you understand?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So yeah. Now we see we have a free market in religion in America. So we had to create a free market of religion. Now, did it mean that it had to be Christian? Because at that point in time, we were a Christian nation. We were. Mm-hmm. Technically, we probably still are. I mean, probably the dominant religion or the dominant faith is Christianity out of all the different faiths. But I don't think it's a majority. In other words, I don't think it's over 50% anymore. It's still the largest, but I don't think that we have a majority of Christians in America today. Because we have way too many people that are secular godless. And that means that all these other different faiths that aren't Christian, you know, are out there competing and actually taking advantage, or basically moving and create. They've created warfare against Christianity, which is why they're getting away with attacking Christianity in education or in the school systems. Because yeah, it's no longer the major voice anymore. Anyway, back to just closing on this. The reason why they didn't have this religious test, or they basically made sure that the federal level, you couldn't have a religious test. They knew at the state level, you could. But when it came down to it, when it came to the offices of the United States, see that at the very end, as a qualification to any office or public trust, under the United States, they could not have a religious test. Doesn't mean you can't have a religious test for your state. Every state had their own religion. They could have instituted and go into all the different state constitutions. Show me where they had a religious test. If they did, it's not there anymore. That's my point. Yeah. Because they got rid of that. Now, the last part of the Constitution is Article 7. And Article 7 is probably the most significant part of the Constitution. And it is the least understood, and it is the shortest part, but there's a little bit to basically be done here, because We're going to jump over the little teeny words, like, you know, these little notes. But what we're going to do is we're going to do the ratification part of this. So go ahead and read the very first sentence, and we'll take it from there.
Ratification of the conventions of 9 states shall be sufficient for the establishment of this constitution between the states, so ratifying the same.
Okay, so what in that one sentence, what did that one sentence tell us? One, it told us that the Constitution was a compact. How did it tell us that? Well, first, it said that this Constitution, for it to become valid, for it to have force, for it to become the law, that it required ratification. What is ratification?
It's an agreement.
It is a formal process of agreeing to a compact, contract, or treaty. So in other words, it is a legal process of accepting a contract or a compact. And in this particular case, we're talking about a compact. And so because it's amongst multiple parties. So it says that it has to have a minimum of 9 states to have acquiesced or to have ratified to accept this Constitution. I mean, even though it is one sentence, this literally says so much because it tells us what the Constitution is. It's not some, you know, ambiguous set of words that have noble intent. It is a compact that the states are the parties to because now it identifies who has the oversight, who has the control over the compact, the states. And is there any significant support of that within the Constitution? Absolutely. Article 5 requires that only the states can ratify and allow changes to this document.
Yeah.
Is there anywhere in this document that gives the federal government the ability to redefine, change, or do whatever they want?
Absolutely not.
So what that means is the annotated Constitution is an abomination regarding this Constitution. They don't have the ability to have a living Constitution and redefine it. That's exactly what they're doing. And it requires the states to say, yea, verily, we will allow it. That's how clear and simple what this line actually states.
Good point.
And so most people think, oh, no, you know, our right to have arms, you know, the right to bear arms is the most important, or freedom of expression. No, if you don't understand who has the overall authority and oversight to, you know, keep government in check. Who is that? Is it the Supreme Court? Is the federal government themselves? No, not at all. It's the states. There you go. And who are the states? Are they just, you know, these legislatures? No, they're a body of representation of the counties and the people in that state. So even though the state legislature may be that body that actually has this oversight, but they are actually the representatives of the county and the state. Well, at least that's what they should be. Because remember, the federal government, and we point this out in Why Counties Matter Most, the federal government started changing and redefining things, and do they have the authority to do that? No. It requires the states to actually allow it. The states must grant it before the federal government can legitimately do it. If the government does it before it is delegated, before it is granted, then it is not a legitimate action. It's not a legitimate expenditure.
Yeah.
Okay. So what we're talking about is fraud at such a massive level that it's just hard for people to get their arms around, which is why every day I start the show off telling you that what you see on that clock, that debt clock, is all fraud. because they've just, there's no limit to what they'll spend money on. Anyway, go ahead and read this last part, because the Dunning Convention by unanimous consent.
Dunning Convention by unanimous consent of the states present the 17th day of September in the year of our Lord 1787 and of the independence of the United States of America, the 12th, in witness whereof we have hereunto subscribed our names.
Okay, so is religion brought up at all in this Constitution?
Only that there'll be no tests.
Well, actually, you just read it. When was this Constitution ratified? Or when was it created? Forgive me. It says right here, the 17th day of September in the year of who?
Year of our Lord.
Our Lord. There you go. So there is a reference to Christ, our Lord, right? Right there. Mm-hmm. That means that this Constitution was done, you know, even though it doesn't mention religion, it does acknowledge all things to the omnipotent Savior. Interesting. People miss that. Anyway, okay, so now we have a whole line of people that supposedly signed this. But it's interesting that they did not include those who didn't sign. Right? In other words, they didn't include the rejections. They only included that it was unanimously, and what that means, unanimously done by the consent of the states, means that they had a majority of the people in each of the states in the convention that ratified or consented to the Constitution. Even though each state had their own dissenters, like George Mason and Governor Randolph were two dissenters coming out of Virginia. But the other three members of Virginia were actually, you know, in favor of and basically signed off. And so that's how it was actually considered the unanimous consent of the states present. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So most people would think, oh, well, it was completely unanimous. Well, actually, it wasn't. But every single state actually did. So the states were unanimous in consenting to this Constitution. So this basically wraps up the Constitution today. So we're done with Articles 1 through 7. And what we need to do is we need to cover the amendments. And what we want to do, what I want to do is we'll get into this tomorrow. We're going to start off with the amendments, and we'll dive into those specifically. And then the rest of the amendments, we're just going to kind of cover at a high level so that we can get through them quickly. Okay?
Sounds good.
All right. So any saved rounds, anything, any other thoughts?
Not at this time.
All right. Well, I'm hoping that this is actually helping you. And more importantly, folks, if you have any questions, if there's anything that we missed or you didn't understand, then just let me know, because understanding the Constitution is paramount. If we're going to actually start getting compliance to it, we have to understand it. And then for people, for our public servants to support it, they too have to understand it. So that's why understanding this is so important. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.